Hello and welcome to the Forward Press Podcast presented by GolfWeek.com. I'm your host, David Dusek. And this week, my guest is Abby Liebenthal. Abby is one of those people in the golf industry that absolutely fascinates me. And I think you should know about. She started out with the AJGA right out of Indiana University. As a Syracuse person, I actually feel that I'm being especially magnanimous by having an Indiana person. And I still haven't forgotten 1987, you Indiana folks. I still remember Keith Smart over Derek Coleman, but I digress. She then worked for the Tiger Woods Foundation. She then helped to run and manage Team Titleist and was really involved with social media at Titleist back in the day. And now she's involved with the U.S. Open and the marketing of the U.S. Women's Open for the USGA. But the biggest thing on Abby's plate is For the Ladies, which, if you don't know about it, is a fantastic nonprofit organization trying to get more young professional women involved in the game of golf. So in the conversation you're about to hear, we talk about all of those things and how people like me, people who love golf and are experienced with it, can make the game more inviting and more open and hopefully a lot more fun for younger people to get involved with, especially younger women. So sit back and enjoy. Now making your first appearance on the Forward Press Podcast, I would like to welcome Abby Liebenthal. Abby is one of those people that if you follow golf on social media, you have seen her or you've certainly seen her work just about everywhere. Instagram, Twitter, Abby Liebs on Twitter, A-B-B-Y-L-I-E-B-S. You can also check out her stuff on Instagram. And she is, I guess it's the founder, the president, the grand kahuna of...
The founder.
it's give yourself a good business card. Have some fun with it. fortheladies.net. You can check out a lot of the programs and things that you that we're going to be talking about quite a bit. But Abby, how you doing? What's new in New Jersey?
It's really cold. Yesterday it dumped snow. I'm really not cut out for it, but at the same time, I think I've just turned soft. I've lived in the Midwest my entire life, and I should be able to be just fine, and still, I hate it. So,
I grew up in Syracuse, New York. I went to school in northern New York, a little place called Canton, New York, St. Lawrence University. Good for hockey, good for, once you're above age, having a beverage or five, and having a really cool golf course that was right behind my dorm, which was fun, and being able to do that stuff. And so, yeah, I'm right there with you. I'm done with the cold. I look at people taking pretty pictures of places like Riviera, even Pebble, which I know is never as warm this time of year as you think it should be.
Sure.
And now that the tours are down in Florida, the women are playing at Lake Nona, the guys or a concession, you see those palm trees and I'm dying. I'm done with it. We've got a foot of snow that's still here in Connecticut and I'm just dying to get outside and it's just not going to happen. And it's depressing. It's very depressing. Did you get into, as the pandemic lockdown sort of kicked in, did you start hitting balls, doing lots of putting inside? Or were you just sort of working on things that kind of thing didn't happen for you?
So the first week that we were at home, we ordered one of those just like putting mats from Birdie Ball and took advantage of that for like a while, like had it like right in the middle of all our living space. But then you're just like over it. So, I mean, you know, we have the Peloton, so we have at least activities to keep us busy inside, but it certainly gets a little, it's getting boring by the day.
I think that everybody went on to Instagram and was showing themselves putting on various putting mats and this and that in March and April. It's like, aha, this is going to be the year I finally know how to putt. And
you're still over it.
You know, it's like, and it's with the best of intentions. You're like, cause at the time, March, April, when things are locked down and in various states, you know, you really can't do much. And a lot of golf courses were closed. It's like, okay, this is how I'm going to get my fix. And I'm going to watch all these old Masters episodes on YouTube, which would be fun. And I'm like, yeah, after 2 or 3 weeks, you're just done with that. And I did the same thing. I actually scored a Peloton right before everything happened. My wife thought it was an extravagance and it's for sure real money, but she then has become more addicted to it. I think she just hit like 250 or 300 rides. I've done a couple hundred straight. And she had this epiphany the Tuesday before things really went down. She was looking around and she did sort of this not CrossFit, but sort of a training thing, you know, 4 mornings a week with 30 people in a gym rotating around. And she's like, I got grossed out. Like just the whole idea of like everybody's sweating and breathing and we're really cramped in and it's 5:30 in the morning. And she's like, no. And she didn't think she would like it, but she ended up doing that. You have a really, really unique background in terms of golf and the things that you have done. How did you get started and sort of walk me through what your introduction to golf is? I think I know this, but I want to hear it from you.
Sure. Well, I mean, golf in general, I grew up playing in Toledo, Ohio. My dad's a big golfer, so I was just introduced to it at a young age. And we played a lot in the summer. I mean, that living in Toledo, Ohio, we have four seasons. So we played a lot of golf growing up. And then once I got to college, I always thought I wanted to be a journalist more in the fashion space, but quickly realized how competitive and how much I don't really know about fashion. So when I was at IU, I spoke to one of my internship advisors and she recommended I check out the American Junior Golf Association internship. I told her I was, you know, I was a casual golfer. It was something I did as a hobby. And I still continued to kind of do it on the side. So she recommended the AJGA internship. So I got the internship and I did it for 2 summers. It was so much fun. I quickly realized I would love to work in golf if I have the opportunity and I'm going to do everything I can to get there. So back at school, I was the beat reporter for the Indiana Daily Student for golf. And yeah, just continued my journey from there. I received a full-time job at the AJGA after I graduated, and it has just kind of spiraled from there. I've worked in golf ever since 2012 when I graduated from IU, and have worked in different industries in golf and different places and nonprofit versus for-profit. But it all started with my experience at the AJGA, which still to this day continues to provide benefits to me, which is pretty amazing. And one of those ways being like, I saw a lot of the junior golfers at the time who are now LPGA and PGA Tour players or Korn Ferry and Symetra Tour based on their age. I'm getting to see them continue their journeys in playing competitively. So it all started with the AJGA and it's kind of continued from there. I mean, it's a laundry list, but it's been rewarding in every single way. So from the AJGA, I went and worked for the Tiger Woods Foundation, in which I supported their media efforts and helped at the PGA Tour events that the Tiger Woods Foundation runs in order to raise funds for the foundation side of things. I learned a lot there. I learned a lot about working for one of the greatest athletes of all time, but I also learned a lot about education and STEM and other parts outside of golf. And then I also learned about how golf can, you know, be a force for good when it comes to providing the funds and the awareness about, you know, things that people should be paying attention to, such as education in the Tiger Woods Foundation case.
So if I can sort of interrupt you real quick, how important is it for someone who's getting started in the world of golf to actually love the sport? It sort of seems like an obvious thing that if you really are passionate about it, you realize, well, my future is not going to lie on playing to pay the mortgage and the bills and in that regard. You show up, you have the idea of going into fashion and different types of journalism and writing. You get encouraged to go to the AJGA, which is cool, and you land that internship. You happen to have golf background, which is one of the reasons why I'm sure that you sort of were encouraged that way. But how critical is it for somebody to actually really love and enjoy the game to be involved in the world of golf?
Yeah, I think like you hit on it in saying that you have to really love it. You don't have to be really good at it by any means, but I think like you do have to love it. I think that the more that I have seen and worked in the industry, like I think that you need to have an expert niche in something. So for me, it's like the digital marketing and the like community engagement. Like those are my passions. In the expertise professional side of things, but you have to complement it with a love for golf. I don't think you need to be a golfer, but if you can at least pay attention and be intrigued by the sport and know who the people are and why golfers love it so much and understand that mentality, then you'll be in a good spot.
someone once told me that your vocation and your avocation, to pull out the SAT words and all that stuff this morning, you want to keep them separate because you can burn out on things really easily. And
yeah,
I think that there's a measure of truth, but you find, or at least I have found, that a lot of people in the industry were passionate about the game, loved it. And it's almost as if like you can't imagine them doing something else. You can't imagine them being an accountant or an architect or a lawyer or, you know, working as totally legitimate professions and careers. But these people are so enamored with this game and all the different facets of it that where the hell else would they be? Like they'd be missing anything else. And it's almost as if like you were destined, and it's, I don't mean to get all into fate and all, but this is who they are. And I don't know that they can burn out on that. If they sort of find, as you're saying, like that one little area of this very vast golf sort of space, they can own that part of the space, or they can be a player in that part of the space. And there are a lot of different rooms within it. I think you and I may have met, it might have been at Aronimink for one of the tournaments, or it might have been at Congressional. I forget. They
started probably Congressional.
Where it was, I don't know if it was the AT&T National at that point, or if it was Quicken Loans, or
Quicken Loans, yeah.
They all sort of start to blend together. That was always a great tournament for me to go to because I could drive, living in New York at that point. It was like a 4.5 or 5 hour drive if I timed the traffic just right. The courses were great. Being around Bethesda, Maryland was nice. There's plenty of convenient stuff. And a week-to-week event when you were working for the Tiger Woods Foundation, you said you were involved with media and Jamooks like myself. What was your role? Like, what were you doing? I would see you up at the front desk. And then I had my head down when I wasn't out on the range or following golfers, like banging away my keyboard. What were you doing?
Yeah, I mean, it was my first experience in kind of like media relations. I was truly doing the like grunt work, to put it simply. I was, you know, doing the media credentials and making sure press releases and ASAP transcripts were being printed and handed to all of you. Like I was, you know, I was just doing everything I possibly could. Yep. But at the same time, like trying to, you know, take advantage of the opportunity as well, like meeting all the media, trying to have conversations with them, trying to understand, like, I didn't really understand what they were trying to achieve. And I didn't, one time Tim Rosefort said to me, like, I was talking to him about something that I was like, oh, you should like learn more about this and like be intrigued. He was like, you need to tell me like, why is this important? Like, why should I care? And so just having conversations like that was always beneficial to me. And, but yeah, I mean, it was truly like writing press releases, providing foundation information to writers or to Tiger Woods Foundation staff so they could speak upon it when they were on site. It was a true media relations, like PR beginner level job.
Yeah, but that's, you know what, it's you learn quickly. Like those are the positions where there's like zero level of glory. And everybody like is, as they say, like, you know, the crap flows downhill. So you get the not fun jobs. And from people like me, the level of patience that we oftentimes display is pretty lousy because we're either writing on deadline or we're getting pitched different things. And to Tim's point, and Tim's about as good a guy as you're ever going to meet, certainly, and ever sort of be around with the media center, is we get pitched ideas and things like that from everybody
on all the time, 100%.
One of the things that my wife has taught me over the years, and it finally got through my thick skull, is that just because something is important to you doesn't mean right now it's important to somebody else. So waiting on an email to be returned, waiting for somebody to return a phone call, or if I'm working on a story and I'm like, I'm two lines away, if I can just talk to this one person or get a reply that I need, I'm done. Well, yeah, I'm done. But that doesn't mean somebody else isn't working on a million other things. And the people who work in media centers tend to be, number one, underappreciated. So in a very belated way, thank you very much for your help from the everybody who works this. But it's also can be like really stressful just because like the immediate somebody comes up to the desk and like they need something now. They don't need it in 5 minutes. They need it right this second. And I work obviously with Steve DiMeglio and he's the king of this, where he's just like flying around like decapitated poultry. And I'm like, Steve, you have to relax. Put down and just let the caffeine level come down, because it's we're going to be fine. Everything is going to be
good. It was a good experience for me. I was just off the AJGA, where everything was very focused on making sure tournaments ran smoothly, right, and, you know, telling those stories, but also making sure like these kids are earning college scholarships, and then, you know, transitioning to a different role in which the stakes are much bigger. I mean, yeah, you know, it's the Tiger Woods Foundation. Yeah. So overall it was an amazing experience. And I learned, you know, you just learn a lot. You learn a lot about what is possible in golf, and then what's possible with the help of the sport extending into like other spaces.
So then you go to Team Titleist, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
What was your role there, and what was that like?
Yeah. So I had a mentor, Dave Asnavorian, and I was talking to him about how I've been in the nonprofit space for a bit and I would love to continue to grow, but I don't really know how to do that. And he was like, you should check, you love golf, you still want to work in golf, you should explore the equipment manufacturers, apparel, look at the businesses out there. Mm-hmm. And Titleist at the time had an opening for a social media coordinator. I did a lot of social for the American Junior Golf Association and dabbled in it with Tiger Woods Foundation. So I applied and got it. And my time there was awesome. I was there for 5 years and did a lot of things I oversaw social media, organic and paid. And then also oversaw Team Titleist, which is their community. It's an online community where they also do some events in person. And it's their way of being, you know, closer connected to the customer. But I learned a lot about what I don't know very quickly at Titleist.
Give me a for instance. Exactly. Yeah.
So, I mean, I didn't know anything about equipment. I knew I loved golf, but I didn't know anything about equipment. So you just put like your head down and try to like listen to all the R&D people and the marketers who have been there for a long time. Like you try to just learn as much as you can about, like, I didn't know anything about like moment of inertia and urethane and like putter inserts. Like I didn't know anything about that. Like I just knew I liked playing golf. So that was like simply like just learn about golf equipment and why, you know, why Titleist is like the number one ball in golf. Like why learn about those things. So that was fun.
I'll clue you into a secret that most people in those meetings are also totally BSing it and they don't know what moment or coefficient of restitution or any of these acronyms actually means. There's about three people in any like 20 person meeting that actually really knows. You know what, that like Stephanie Luttrell is going to be one of them.
Fantastic person.
Big
yeah.
brain. Very, very yes. big brain. If you're somebody who really likes Titleist drivers or fairway woods, yeah, she should be on your holiday card list because she's the one and her team driving that stuff. Bill Morgan, when he was really driving the ship for the Pro V1, Pro V1X, like those are the people. You get into a lot of the folks on the periphery of that. These are complicated things. And I know just enough to realize I don't know anything. And that's my job to know this.
Yeah.
It's so detailed. So coming from different backgrounds to this, could be a daunting kind of a thing. How much did social media within golf change while you were there?
So because much.
Right there in the sweet spot.
Oh my gosh. It like blew up. And it blew up for all of the equipment manufacturers. You know, I came into it and Callaway is now thriving with their Callaway Media Productions and TaylorMade has Ollie taking these amazing photos and videos. Like the space became competitive really quickly. So it was just a really big learning curve. I also think that with social, the idea of sponsored social media posts and using advertising to support all the content, like that was still like a growing sector and just understanding what all these different things mean. But I think overall, like at Titleist, I was quickly learning how can marketing support the bottom line? How can marketing support the business and trying to understand that better? It was quite a learning curve for me, especially for somebody who always worked in nonprofit. I never had to like share a sales goal.
Like, why do I have to put this down? Because now it's going to be held against me if I don't meet it is always the apprehension. How much, and this is not meant to be a loaded question, but as that world in terms of online and social marketing is blossoming, and we're seeing all different kinds of things being tried by different OEMs. And you're as dialed in probably as anybody at Titleist or the whole Acushnet world, which is Titleist and FootJoy and Vokey Wedges and Scotty Cameron putters and all different kinds of things. How challenging was it at that point to get people who may not be fluent in social media to understand how these different mechanisms work and how it can directly go to bottom line? You can not only grow a community, which I would imagine, you know, 2014, 2015, people think like, oh, that sounds great, but what the hell do we do with it? How do we monetize it or get that to be something beneficial? And why am I listening to, you know, no offense, like somebody who might be like 25 or 26, tell me who's been here, you know, in an established brand for 25 years, like, this isn't how we need to change the business.
Yeah, no, it was tough. I spent a lot of time creating presentations about what social media is. I think that there was also the perception of, well, I have a Facebook, I have an Instagram, I have a Twitter myself, so like I must be an expert.
I'm gonna do yeah, I can hear it.
Yeah, yeah, and that's okay. Like, like your contribution to social media is just as important as mine. Because I need you to share the Titleist stuff. I need you to like the Titleist posts. I need you to like engage with our stuff. So I think like that was more of what I was trying to explain to people at the time, was like, we actually need you. We need your help because we need you to engage. We need you to share. We need you to comment on everything Titleist is doing so that we can continue to extend it. Because, you know, then you would run into silly things like, well, I never see our posts. And so then you have to like try to explain like what an algorithm is. It's like extremely complex outlet, and people are still figuring it out.
I've been in some of those meetings before, and when I joined Golf Week in 2013, having come from Golf and Sports Illustrated, and the level of savviness within the organization around social media was, I'm going to call out my own company. It was low at the time, to put it.
Sure.
Because everything changes really, really fast. I think everybody in the room when I did a presentation on it and helped out some other people who were doing it as well, everybody had a Facebook account. And I'm there telling them like, okay, Facebook is for the 40 and over crowd. You have to understand that, for example, my son, backtracking like 3 or 4 or 5 years, whatever the hell it was, I'm like, he's doing different stuff. Like, this is, and if we're trying to get younger, more dynamic, reach out to people beyond our own demo, like, we need to go to where they are and be a part of that conversation on their terms, not necessarily put this very simple thing out there. And it's a big leap of faith for a lot of people. Like, you know, they're busy with their own jobs and with their own responsibilities, and to take on more and different stuff as it's continuously evolving, I think number one is humbling, which a lot of people just aren't willing to say, like, I don't know how this works.
Sure.
And it takes a willingness and an open-mindedness to listen to people who, because of the nature of the job, tend to be younger than they are, and to have faith that these people know what they're doing, and I'm going to trust them, even if they have less prolonged career experience, they know this better than I do, and I'm going to relinquish control. That's frightening for a lot of people. They really, and I think for brands, quote unquote, it can be really frightening, but it seems like most companies have given way to that you're willing to relinquish some of the control of the message to your audience and be a part of that. It's got to be scary as hell, though. How did you try and get people to understand and to buy in that, like, we want to have conversations like this and we want to use these mechanisms to grow our business and to grow our presence within the world of golf, but we're not always going to be in control of exactly how things are presented. That had to have been tough.
Yeah. It's such a reactive industry, in social media specifically, because you see somebody post something and you're like, oh my gosh, they think horribly of us, or somebody's going to see this and what are we going to do next? And it's fine. I think I always was just like, it's fine. It's not a big deal. The post is going to, there'll be something else in the feed that pisses everybody off in just a few moments. Yeah, right. So I think it was more about providing examples. Look at this win that we had. Look at, you know, somebody would share with us a hole in one that they had with a Titleist golf ball, and they tagged us and they did everything right. We had to continue to pull those moments so that we could share them later and say, hey, there, you know, we see a lot of negative on social media, and that hasn't even changed in 2021, but there's a lot of positives too. Let's keep track of what those are. Let's make sure we engage with those moments and share those moments so that people see that we're having wins as well. I think that was like the best way that I could share what social media could do, was always making sure I pulled examples. Cause like, you can say it, but if you don't see it, you don't really believe, you can't believe us. So like, me, who's 24 years old or whatever I was at the time, mm-hmm. you're not going to necessarily believe what I have to say about how great social media is. But if you can see it, and if I can provide you a visualization, it's much easier.
So the trick for you becomes to understand the message that needs to be, you know, gotten across.
Sure.
English major, gotten. My professors are cringing as I sit here. But you have to put it in terms and in ways, whether it's visual or auditory, that are going to strike. Like, this is the language they speak. Oh,
yeah.
Speak the fact that, like, we got this really positive engagements, and over the last quarter, the last month, or whatever the time period is, like, look at how many people came and talked Titleist in this case.
Right.
About this or that. You then have now transitioned. Well, you're not wearing a blue blazer, so I might, you're sort of incognito. You're with the USGA these days. What
are
you
doing
with the United States Golf Association? What are you doing?
So I work specifically on the U.S. Open. I am my title is the senior manager of U.S. Open fan experiences. So I work on the Victory Club, which is the official fan club of the U.S. Open and of the U.S. Women's Open. It's been a wild ride. I started February of last year. I was in the office for maybe 3 to 4 weeks, and then we all picked up and went home. So it's been an interesting year. You know, I don't get those casual walk bys. I didn't get those opportunities to casually meet people as they saw, oh, look, there's a new girl here. So it's been an interesting year, but I support the brand marketing team, and I work on the US Open, but I get to touch a few other projects as well. And I think I'm where I'm supposed to be. It's been fun. You know, I started in nonprofit. I then worked for Titleist as well as Imperial Headwear for a little bit.
That was a quick one. That was a cup of coffee.
It was quick. It was very quick. But I loved my time there. You know, the USGA came to me with this opportunity, and I was like, I can't say no. So I get to work on a major championship, which is amazing. And I do feel like I'm where I should be. I started in a nonprofit, went to for-profit, and I'm kind of back, but now I get to serve the industry, which I think is something I never even considered.
So far be it from me to shy away from asking the really stupid questions, but why does the US Open and the US Women's Open need marketing? Like, these are our and I ask that sort of, you know, because I think it's the quiet, like a tournament, for example, like the Masters, doesn't need marketing. You get the Jim Nantz flowery language when you're watching something in December or January, and people are just amped as all get out to be able to watch the Masters. And then through the Final Four Championship, I always, my Masters lead up, and when I start to really get dialed in, is when we get to the end of college basketball season, because I know once the tournament starts, we're ending on the Monday of Masters week. So my countdown is going. The US Open has been a huge hit for, oh, I don't know, a hell of a long time.
Yeah.
I was fortunate enough to be, again, at Winged Foot this last year. I've been to the last several Opens. It's amazing. Like, it's unbelievable. The U.S. Women's Open, and I want to talk to you specifically about that in just a second, this last November, to me, was enormous. It was epically successful in terms of just, like, its presence on the calendar. I loved the fact that we had to have it, that we got to enjoy it, number one, was also great. What's the goal in terms of, like, marketing a major championship already? Why is this necessary?
You know, it's necessary because you think that because you are in the golf world. But as a major championship, we should be extending beyond golf fans. People should be tuning in from across sports. And, you know, there is there is a bigness to the US Open, as you just shared, but we can do even more. And we can, the beauty of the major championships is that people who don't tune in week after week to the PGA Tour, they may pop in and they may tune into a golf major championship. So I think there's just, there's always a lot of work to do. I think that you want to also make it a better experience. I think that, you know, we have the golf fan, but just because we have them doesn't mean we shouldn't make the experience better, whether that be across all, every way that you can tune into the championship. We can always make it better for the fan.
So the aforementioned, and we're all sort of tired of talking about COVID, strikes in March. And obviously, you know, everything sort of grinds to a halt. The PGA Tour picks things up in June. The LPGA Tour picks things up shortly thereafter. The U.S. Open takes place in September. And so that would happen. The U.S. Women's Open takes place in November down at Champions. In a very, very strange and terrible way, how big of an opportunity and how much of a boost did the U.S. Open Championship, U.S. Women's Open Championship, how much of a boost did they get from actually being sports that were taking place rather than many other sports and many other, you know, seasons that either were dramatically shortened up or changed? Baseball plays a 60-game season. It sort of feels strange. The World Series happens. Okay. The NBA season goes into a bubble and they're sort of doing those things. And it's difficult to measure how successful that was in terms of like audience engagements and things like that. I think people were into it, but it's hard to tell. It felt like the U.S. Open and the U.S. Women's Open were significantly bigger, that at least, and again, I'm within this. So I was, you know, sort of already going to watch anyway, but
right,
more people got dialed in. And the U.S. Open is one of those events, at least on the men's side with the Masters, where people have nothing to do with golf, take to social media and be like, holy cow, did you see what Bryson DeChambeau did? Oh my gosh, look what Dustin Johnson just did. Celebrities, all kinds of personalities, will for a little while, they'll be following this stuff. How big an opportunity, when looking back on those tournaments, did we get a boost for a terrible reason from COVID, do you think, in terms of just the buzz that those championships created?
Yeah, I mean, I can't really speak to like the specific numbers. I'm sure you could ask Craig or Navin, but just tangentially, like when you look at social media, people were talking about it and the attention was there. And I think that, you know, that just from my perspective, like, I don't know if the ratings were so much higher. I don't know if viewership was incredibly higher, but it was exciting that everybody got their own time. You know, you had the Masters had its own moment being in the fall, and that created a new storyline for the U.S. Open. We were, you know, we were also in the fall, and the U.S. Women's Open being in the winter, it just provided a different story. It was something different. It was unique. It wasn't the middle of the summer like we're used to. So I think, you know, just from my perspective, it was different, and we learned a lot. You know, typically the Women's Open is like almost right before the Men's Open. Yep. So it was interesting to see what it was like, you know, just being a staff member and having a big time difference to give more attention to the different championships. So I think it was just different. I don't know if it's better. I don't know if it's worse. I think, you know, in my mind, I think of major championships and I think of in the men's and the women's game happening spring and summer. So I'm excited for them to come back to their normal times this year. So
I think we all are. And it's the championship season. You know what? Golf is, we're around it all the time. But to me, golf is certainly here in the Northeast, something that hopefully we can sneak in shortly after St. Patrick's Day. Although I got to tell you, I'm not holding my breath right now.
There's a lot of snow.
And there's going to be a lot of wet after a lot of snow. But if, you know, basically like April through, say, like Halloween, I'm always feeling like if I'm in November and I'm playing golf in the Northeast, I'm stealing. And I'm happy to steal. But realistically, there is a championship season. It usually culminates after, you know, historically, then because we've changed around everything. Now, after the Open Championship, and this year it'll be after Ryder Cup. So, like, once we get to the end of September and the FedEx Cup has finished its season, all the major championships for the men and the women basically are finished up. There's some big tournaments and big events that we get jazzed about, but the championships are, you know, in my mind, April through September. And yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. Tell me about For the Ladies, because in addition to working obviously with the USGA and having that be, I'm sure, more than a full-time gig, this is a fascinating organization and movement to me. And for people who aren't aware, fortheladies.net is where you can learn about this. And Abby, what is it and why was it necessary to start this?
Yeah, so we are a female-based community with the intent to get more young professional women playing golf, put it as simply as possible. But the reason I started it was when I was at Titleist, I was just realizing that there wasn't a lot of opportunities for young professional women to learn how to play golf. Growing up, I had a great junior golf experience. And even today, there are amazing programs like LPGA, USGA Girls Golf that are tailored to get young girls into the game and to play the sport. And then on the other end of the spectrum, I noticed that there were a lot of opportunities for executive women or women in leadership positions to participate in these like executive women's leadership days. But most of the time it was open to like CEOs or CMOs, women of, you know, the top leadership positions. And I noticed there just wasn't anything in between. There was a lot for junior golf. There was a lot for women who maybe were in leadership positions, or maybe they were retired and now had the time to go learn how to play golf at a country club. But there wasn't a lot available for young professional women. So in March 2019, I hosted my first For the Ladies clinic, and I invited a few friends because growing up, I didn't have many friends who played golf, but now they were all like, well, I want to learn, or like, where, how do I even start? What's the process here? And so I held an event in March 2019 at Newport Indoor Golf, and 70 women showed up, and I was like in awe. I couldn't believe that many women had randomly heard about this For the Ladies clinic that I was going to be hosting. And from there, I just realized if you create the opportunity for women to learn how to play the game or just be introduced to the sport, mm-hmm. they're going to take advantage of it. And my thing has always been, if you can remove the barriers and just let women decide if they like the sport and want to play, then we've already set them up for success. But when there's barriers in the way or you feel intimidated, we don't even give people the opportunity to give it a shot. So that's how For the Ladies started. Our bread and butter is the clinics, and they're truly just introduction to golf clinics. You're not getting like intense instruction. You're not getting a one-to-one experience per se, but you're being introduced to the game. You're seeing, you know, what is the golf apparel look like now? It's not just khakis and a polo. What does instruction look like though? How do I hold a golf club? What does the atmosphere look like? I've never even stepped foot on a golf course. Like, what does this look like? And we provide that opportunity. So that's what we do. That's the clinics, and it's expanded beyond the For the Ladies clinics. We do other things. We have, you know, a podcast, and we have a directory that you can sign up for to find other women in your area who play golf. And we have a newsletter. We're doing as much as we can. And obviously that is because COVID hit. Yeah.
I think I'm tired of having to sort of bring this out, but trying to make something good out of something that was lousy, it would seem like, and I want to hear if you would agree or disagree with this, but last year with 2020, once golf courses around the U.S. were pretty much back up and running, which I think Massachusetts was the last one in early May that reopened, we changed a lot of the ways that golf is played. A lot of the traditions and a lot of the things that or the rituals around the game went right out the window. And for me personally, good riddance. I'm fine with that. Did that make it easier to get people, especially women who had maybe never played, involved? Because the process, for example, like, oh, I'm going to play today and I don't have a lot of experience, like checking in, which is one of these like more arcane things, all of a sudden becomes something that I would do at my local place, like on my phone.
Sure.
That like doing, you know, a lot of people started to walk a golf course rather than like dealing with a cart, going with starts, like taking the pin out, standing through, like it seemed like everything became significantly more casual and just like, hey, let's just be cool about this. And
yeah,
I would think that makes it easier, or am I being naive about this?
So in 2020, we didn't like host any clinics. So from the Four Little Ladies perspective, it was kind of a wash. But playing golf and just being able to go out there, sure, it was a little bit easier. At the same time, it was extremely like crowded, like that you couldn't get a tee time because that was the only activity that you could do. So I would say it's a mix of things. You know, I am a little hesitant to say that all of the traditions and rituals are gone. I think there's a lot of struggles and a lot of issues that we all need to face still when it comes to like, especially when it comes to like imposter syndrome in golf. Like I want to make women feel like they should be out there. And I think we've come a long way, and 2020 like definitely opened people's eyes to the sport, which is amazing. But I hope we can maintain it, and I hope that we don't revert maybe to some of our old ways.
Hallelujah. people who may be unaware or just not have given this very much thought at all, what are some of the biggest barriers, in your opinion, to getting more women, especially, say, women 30 and under, involved with golf? How do we get them to feel comfortable in and around golf facilities?
Yeah, I think there's a few things. Just offering more opportunities that are female focused. You know, a wine and dine at 2 o'clock on a Tuesday isn't super realistic for a young professional. Like, I'm not going to take off work to just go play golf. I can't. I don't have enough days. but you know, I think that would be one way. You know, think about what your women's programming looks like and think about the audience that you're trying to reach. If it's a young professional female, you're going to have to look at the Saturday or Sunday, or you're going to have to look at the after 5 o'clock crowd, and make it, you know, create those opportunities for women. I also think that some of the other barriers come with the instruction. Instruction can be expensive, but that's because it's worth it. And because that's what you need, in my opinion, to get better at playing golf and feeling more comfortable. But how can we be flexible? Can we create clinics that are maybe for 6 women to, you know, come back week after week to learn a new lesson in golf, rather than maybe a private instruction? It's always, to me, you know, doing something in golf is always more fun with a friend, especially as a female. You don't want to be the only person walking around the golf course who is of the female gender. Like, you want to have somebody else out there with you. And that's what I'm always trying to preach, I guess, is like the barriers to entry are a little bit on the golf course, but also on, you know, the golfers themselves. I think you have to go out there with a friend. Especially if you're just learning how to play golf. But then there also needs to be opportunities for women. Do you have rental clubs that are for women at your course? Because if I'm a brand new golfer, I might not go buy golf clubs. I don't know if I'm gonna like this sport. Why would I go spend, you know, $1,200 on a set of golf clubs? Yep. So do you have rental clubs for women? Just thinking about that female perspective, at your facility, I think is huge.
It seems like it's something of a circular argument that I can just hear men in their 50s and 60s running golf facilities having within their own mind. Okay, that sounds great. I'm going to have rental sets for women, maybe do clinics at, you know, when the daylight allows it, 7 o'clock on Wednesdays or Thursdays, and doing different programs. But either A, they're thinking, if I buy these rental sets, they're never going to get used because I don't have any women here anyway. So you get into this cycle of like,
totally a chicken or egg situation.
Which is total BS to me. I'm like, well, if you don't have it, then you're right. You're not going to be out that money and you're never going to utilize it. And you have to think beyond that. And then it's as simple as a thing is like that. So my wife, who is in her early 50s, is very eager to start and has been talking with friends. And I have been really encouraging her not just to play, but to do it with friends, because anytime I think you learn something new, there is an element of, well, golf is hard for anybody to learn. And if you're going to go through that experience where it's going to be frustrating or challenging, why not do it with other people so that you can sort of share that part and hopefully just relax yourself and put your little self a little bit more at ease. We're really fortunate to have a very simple, basic par 3 course, 9 holes, that's at a practice facility about 30 minutes from our house. and it's where my kids go to take lessons, and you can play holes. The first hole, I think, is like 80 yards, which for somebody who's learning, perfect. Absolutely perfect. I think the longest hole might be like 250. Great. You know what? Have fun. Have at it. To have experiences like that with friends who are also just learning, to me, feels ideal. But that's also, I think, a rarity. There just aren't enough of those types of facilities.
There's not. And I think that's why thinking about, like, if you're a facility and you want more people to come to your club or your golf course, think about the ways to be flexible. You know, there was a place I was going in New Jersey a lot this summer, and they didn't have a 9-hole rate. And I'm like, gosh, this is so frustrating. Like, I don't want to play 18 every time I go out there, or I don't have time. And there were a few times I even just went by myself, and I would just leave. And I'm like, I wasted so much money just now. And I'm like kicking myself, but I love golf. So it's different. But if I'm somebody who's like newer to the sport, and there's not even an option for me to play less than 18 holes, then I'm not going to go there. And I think like, that's where we all just need to be more flexible. And I can preach it as much as I want, but at the end of the day, like you just have to kind of internalize, like, okay, we want more people to come. What do we need to do? And like, there are solutions out there.
For sure. And it seems like it's one of those things where anybody who's got a level of business savvy is trying to, you know, not to get totally
wild,
you want to get higher utilization on your tee sheet, then you're going to fill in within a reason, because nobody wants to wait forever and a day on a tee box.
Of course.
What's the problem with selling a 9 holes there that otherwise would go unsold? If you go up on any number of different apps at local golf facilities, you're going to see plenty of like, oh, there's a foursome that can go off here, 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 here throughout the course of the day. Well, filling up 9 holes, and if, like, you know, if it's going to cost $40 for 18, charging $25 for 9 on a golf on a tee time that would otherwise go unsold, you win. Like, and you've hopefully get somebody who has a good experience and they keep coming back a few more times. So you get that 25 plus, and maybe they go into the pro shop, or maybe they take a lesson, or like, yeah, when it's more exclusionary, I more often than not do play 9 holes rather than 18. My favorite of the summer is to wake up early, get out for like, say, 7 or 7:30, play 9, and then be at my desk being able to work by like 9:15, 9:30 in the morning. I feel like I've been cheating. It feels like I've been cutting school and I got my fix. And now I can do it, and I don't have to tell anybody that I already played today. And usually the way I play, I don't cop to that anyways. I had a really interesting experience. I went on an airplane 2 weeks ago for the very first time since the pandemic started. U.S. Open was a drive for me. Travelers, Northern Trust, in the car. Mm. Felt totally safe. Went to Arizona. Double masked on the plane. Was tested while I was out there. Was basically hotel room to Whole Foods takeout, to golf facility, to hotel room. It was, that was it. Had a chance though to play over at Wekopa, which played the Saguaro course, which is rated by Golf Week magazine as the number one course you can play in Arizona. And it is sensational. Absolutely amazing. Nice. Loved it. Played with 2 women and 1 older guy. I played from the purple tee. So I was playing at about 6,500 yards, which is about what I play at home. Loved it and adored it. The women were playing from the forwardmost tees, and I know that they took lessons and were serious players, because one of the women would line up, put the peg down, and she would address the ball, then take her club and sort of lay it across her hips to check her alignment. And that is a taught move. You don't just pick up a golf club and decide, I'm going to start doing this. Like, somebody told you to do this, and she did it on every shot, and she could really play. And one of the reasons, or one of the things that was just sort of this aha moment for me, is we played the 9th hole, and it was maybe about 130 yards, and I hit a pitching wedge in there and promptly dumped it into a front bunker. And she, from her forward tee, played a pitching wedge right to the middle of the green, had a 2-putt par, and went on her merry way. But as we were walking to the green, she happened to mention to me, it is so nice to be able to hit a pitching wedge to a par 3. And I was sort of perplexed by this. I'm like, well, why? What's the big deal? And it sort of occurred to me that there aren't many tee boxes set up for the women's or the most forward tees. And women don't always play from the most forward tee, so I don't want to overdo this. But they did. And I thought back, I'm like, okay, the other par 3, which I forget the number, like, she hit driver and just barely made over the Barranca and eventually got on the putting surface. And oh yeah, by the way, she made birdie on that hole. Then we get to number 18. and 18 is a downhill and then back uphill over this sort of little barranker thing or whatever the hell they call it out there. And I hit my shot. The guy I'm playing with plays from 1T4. So he hits his shot to basically the same place I am. And I see them walking down the hill. And they walk right past the most forward tees. And they keep walking. And I'm walking behind them. And I caught up. And I asked them, are you just not going to play this hole? They said, oh, no. Even from the most forward tees, we can't reach the fairway. We can't clear that even with driver. And it was maybe about a 140-yard shot. And like I said, it's a sensational Crenshaw and Coors design. It's a destination if you're out there in the Scottsdale area and have a chance to play it. But it made me sort of stop to think that on the one hand, we had this great thing where the women in the most forward tees could play a pitching wedge the way that the hole theoretically, quote unquote, is supposed to be played. On another, there were one or two holes where they couldn't play. And I don't know that this is necessarily like a women's specific question or sort of situation that I'm bringing up to you. But how many courses do you think aren't necessarily designed for women or for beginners to be able to play them well? Because certain holes and certain shots, you know, the stereotypical Florida par three, you're hitting it over water. There is no bailout.
Right.
Which if you're somebody who has struggling, you've taken two lessons and this is maybe your first round of golf and you've got 100 yards that you have to carry, that's intimidating.
It's
intimidating for everybody. There's no way around it. And what in your opinion, from your experience, like, is that a common problem or is that just not, is that more of a regional? It doesn't really kick in that much.
I think it is a common problem. And it doesn't matter the gender. Say you're just an amateur golfer who needs to play from the forward tees. If you are playing the forward tees and like you said, you have to carry it 100 yards to be safe in the fairway, that's not beneficial to the amateur golfer. They're not going to enjoy it. They're probably just going to pick up and then toss it to the front of the fairway. So I've listened to a lot of, you know, the Fried Egg and Andy Johnson commentary about this, and they're great when they talk about it. You know, any course where you can kind of, you know, hit it and bump and run it, or the, you know, the fairways are running and you can let the ball just like roll across, that's beneficial to an amateur golfer. So if you need, you know, if your course doesn't look like that, but you can change the tee so that that's the play, then that's definitely beneficial. I would say to anybody, I've run into the issue a lot. I've played a lot of Florida courses where I always play the forward tees and I still have to, you know, carry it over a marsh or a pond, whatever it may be. And it's the worst thing in the entire world, but there's a lot of courses, you know, that are now they understand that. And hopefully like it's just somebody needs to be thinking in that way. You know, somebody needs to say like, hey, this isn't working. This tee box is not working. And no, not every course has the money to create a new tee box, but then just put it in the fairway and that's okay. You know, just drop the tees in the fairway or wherever like a, you know, a flat patch of land is. But yeah, it's definitely something that like you have to be more cognizant of. And it's something you guys clearly saw firsthand.
And I'm not going to lie. It's not something I've really given a whole lot of thought to because most of the,
if you don't play with people that are truly amateurs or like beginners, like you're not going to see it.
So the next time I'm out and I have an opportunity to play with somebody who is very new to golf, what are some of the things as somebody who has been around the game, fortunately for a long time, that I need to keep in mind or that I should do or not do to make them feel more comfortable or less self-conscious if they have a better time?
Well, one, inviting them is a great first step. But additionally, I think like try to understand how much they want to be told and guided. There are some, you know, I have a friend that I played with this time, this year, who she was just learning how to play golf. And so we would play together a lot and she would hit it, you know, she would miss it or she would hit it into the trees. And I'm like, hey, if you want to just pick it up and throw it in the fairway, like I'm going to do the same thing. And maybe like I kind of like lead by example. If I have a really bad shot, I just say, hey, I'm just going to throw this here because I want to make her or him feel more comfortable. If that's not what they want, like they want to hit, they want to play it as it lies. Also let them do that too. But like, just have that conversation up front so you can be encouraging. And then, you know, nobody wants to embarrass themselves, but at the same time, you have to remind them that like nobody's good. The people who are good are being paid. That's why they're, you know, playing out there professionally. So I, you know, invite them out, try to understand how they want to play the sport. You know, are they like, gosh, I just want to like maybe hit a few shots and then drop it on the putting green. Great. So I would say like, those are the two big things. And anytime you could invite somebody new is going to be a good thing for the sport.
I love playing with people that are new. One of the things that I make a point of never doing unless they ask, and sometimes after a few holes, like I'll, so is I don't give swing tips because I'm not a pro.
No. Oh my gosh.
Like you see somebody relatively new and you're like, okay, this is screaming for help, but it's not my place.
Let them figure it out. Yeah.
Part of the journey is getting to this. And maybe afterwards or on the turn, I might just be like, hey, if I've got something, an idea for you, but it's up to them.
But you tell me if you want me to share with
you. I'm not going
to
like, my name is not Nicholas. Like it's not my position to sort of come off here, but as I'm going out here shooting like 85 or 86, I'm not the one to be looking for swing tips from. So
yes, it's supposed to be fun. Keep it fun. And that's okay.
When I play, I'm all about the fun. That's why the music is going. Yeah. There's going to be food. There's going to be a drink. And when I leave, I want to be eager to come back. And hopefully play with people that I have a good time with. And that to me is like it's supposed to be fun. It's a game, right? Like what the hell? Let's go. Abby, I really, really appreciate your coming on. Yeah. Can you once again sort of tell people where they can follow you and learn more about For the Ladies?
Yeah. So For the Ladies, you can follow us on Instagram. It's FORE the Ladies. And then the same thing. and then our website is fortheladies.net. That's where you can see where all the upcoming clinics are, where you can sign up for the directory, find ways to support For the Ladies as we are a nonprofit organization. And thanks for the support. Thanks for having me on.
You got it. Best of luck. Thanks a lot.
Thanks. Talk to you soon.
You got it.